All right. It is a Thursday morning. Thursdays are our day for the Burning Platform, and today is no different. We will be talking politics as we do on a Thursday, and we've been speaking to party leaders from all the various parties. And one of the parties, Pumi and I, saw the posters in Cape Town the other day with Auntie Pat on them. And today we are talking to the good party. Canthan, how are you?
I've got echo.
Let me just shut him down there. There we go. No, I got you. I got you now. Go on. There. You were saying?
So the interesting thing about the Baltimore ship.
Yeah.
Is that there are already conspiracy theories going around it.
Of course there are. It takes 5 seconds for a conspiracy theory to come up. What are they?
Except this one comes from our fellow South African, from Lara Logan.
Yeah.
And according to her intel sources, this was a cyber attack that shut down the ship's engines, and it was actually timed to take out the bridge.
What do you think the probability of this particular conspiracy theory being true?
Look, Lara Logan's kind of interesting because I think that 80% of the time her sources are accurate. I don't know whether this is part of the 20%.
But cyber attack by whom?
Aha. Now, who has the technological capability to interfere in American elections and take down bridges? Putin on the Ritz.
Russia, they've got
terrorists in their cities. They've got their own guys. Trying not to swear.
We don't call Russia. We don't call them terrorists.
Russia. Yeah. That's all I'm going to say. All right. Welcome Brett. Brett Herron is, of course, with the Good Party, and it is a pleasure to have him here in studio. The last time we spoke to you was online. He's the Secretary General of Good. And how are things going with Good at the moment? Tell us, give us a little update before we start asking you about policies and elections and what you guys are planning and where you're going to be, and Auntie Pat and Peter de Villiers and a whole lot of other stuff.
We've got an hour.
We've
got a lot to talk to you about, yeah. But tell us how things are going.
I think things are going well. We had our first national elective conference in November. We elected our leadership. We adopted policies. We amended our constitution to make provision for engaging with parties after the election if needed. So things are going well. We've been more prepared for this election than we were for the previous two. And that's obvious given that we're only 5 years old, so you would get more prepared. So I think we're doing well.
But Brett, every party that's been in here has given us wildly optimistic figures for what they're expecting in this election. I mean, Kenneth Meshwe was saying 10% of the national vote is going to the ACDP. You're nodding in a derogatory fashion. You're looking, like most of us, in disbelief at these numbers. Bantu Holomisa says he's going to get great numbers, but someone's got to lose when everybody says they're going up. And the Good Party, obviously, you've had a little more profile with one of our ministries being essentially given to Patricia de Lille. So she's had a lot more national prominence maybe than many of the other politicians. But do you think that your numbers are going to go up?
Yes, I think they're going to go up, but I'm not predicting 10% or 20% or
okay,
that
we.
And you'll see that our manifesto doesn't suggest that we're going to be in government or be the government. I mean, we're realistic. We're a young party. We're growing, and we grew from 2019 to 2021, and we would like to grow in 2024. We occupy an interesting space in the political spectrum. We don't have a populist message, and we are offering a reasonable response to South Africa's challenges in a progressive political space. And we'll grow. I'm not going to sit here and say we're going to get 10%.
No, I think that's a smart answer.
Why do you think you will grow when there are so many more parties that are playing in the space that you have traditionally kind of been the only ones in?
I think we're going to grow, I mean, first of all, because we're more organized, and politics is not... the results for political contestation is not achieved by looking at social media. It's what you're doing on the ground, working in communities, and we've been doing that. Although by-election results are not the only thing to go by, we've seen growth in every by-election we've contested except two, and we've contested in about almost 20 over the last 2 years. So I think that there's a there is growing support for us in an environment where there's declining support for the old parties who have been in government and have created the environment in which people are suffering.
Well, I'm going to address the elephant in the room because Gayton McKenzie is not an old party and he's been on here. And he's been very vocal about the fact that he believes that at their core, his party are a coloured people's party. He said that's the vote that he's going for unashamedly. And any, you know, additional help they get from other people is fine. But that's who he's going for. Is that not a threat, as it might be for the DA in the Western Cape, to good? Are Gayton McKenzie and the Patriotic Alliance not meant to be the people chiefly in your target?
I don't think so. I think that assumes that coloured people are homogeneous and that they're all going to support the same thing. Our policies, our approach to politics is wildly different to Gayton McKenzie and the Patriotic Alliance. And where we've contested with them, they have beaten us in some elections and we've beaten them in others. And so I think we mustn't view the coloured community as one community that will that is being captured or consumed by Patriotic Alliance.
I completely agree with you.
And we are appealing to rational, reasonable people who would like to see South Africa progress and who believe in human rights. And so I think we have a different constituency.
Okay. I think that's a fair comment. But yeah. I think one of the questions that then comes to mind, if we're looking at the fact that we don't consider coloured people to be homogenous, the single issue right now that I think that's dividing that particular community is the Israel-Palestine conflict. And it's very clear.
You don't go in with soft questions,
no,
Kenton.
No, it's not a soft question. And it's very clear that, I mean, we've got 2 million Muslims in South Africa, and most of them happen to be coloured people in the Western Cape. And they're very clearly, very firmly on the side of the Palestinians in this particular conflict. So where does your party stand on that particular thing? And more importantly, how do you then negotiate that very obvious divide, given that that's your strongest base?
Well, I mean, we've been supporters of sovereignty for Palestine since we were formed. And we've been involved in protests and championing that cause since 2019. We, in 2020, we had a billboard up here in Johannesburg saying justice for Palestine. So, I mean, our support for the people of Palestine and for their sovereignty and the right to occupy their own land predates the 7th of October
so
attacks.
So is that a differentiator between you guys and Gayton?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are firmly in support of justice for Palestine and we supported the government's approach to the ICJ. In fact, I think that my question to the Minister Durko actually prompted the application to the ICJ because I submitted a question to her saying, we've got this genocide convention. Has South Africa thought of using it? And then 6 weeks later, we were
so
announced.
So you gave her the idea.
I can't say it, but I mean, I did ask a question when it wasn't being mentioned publicly.
And how's that gone for us, huh?
Well, I think it was the right thing to do. I mean, obviously, it has its own provocations, but it was the right thing to do. And sometimes you have to do the right thing, even if it's hard.
All right. So, Patricia, because she always comes up, can the guest? This is from one of our listeners. Please explain why your leader is in the cabinet, propping the ANC up, and has been in a million parties since 1994.
Well, I don't think she's been in a million parties since 1994. We do have 115 on the ballot, but she hasn't been in all of those. And I think
has she even been in a majority of those?
Yeah, I mean, she started her own party, started the ID, and that merger into the DA was part of an attempt to realign the opposition. It was based on some values that were agreed before the merger took place. The DA were not able to live up to those values, and so many of us exited, including me. Mm.
The DA has a steady flow of people out.
Yes, and for good reason. But this question around the cabinet is really strange because it's as if South Africa has amnesia. We've had an opposition leader in the cabinet, in every cabinet since 1994. We had Chief Buthelezi. Yeah. He was in two cabinets in the 1994.
Martinus van Schalkwyk. Remember Martinez, him, Gortbruch?
We had the leader of the Freedom Front Plus in Zuma's cabinet.
Right.
So what? I don't understand why people have forgotten that other leaders have been in the cabinet, and that doesn't mean that those parties have been captured.
Maybe it's because there's a special category with Patricia, and I'll give her credit, and I always do, that she was the one who lifted the lid on the arms deal. She developed a reputation for being a no-nonsense politician in the beginning who couldn't be swayed this way or the other by bribes and treachery and manipulation, the way that politicians are used to working in this country. And maybe because she had that unbelievable and unassailable reputation before, many people found it disappointing that she'd come into government. Now, how's she been performing, in your opinion, as a minister? Because that's a whole separate thing. You know, once you get given the job, for good or for bad, you then are there to prove something. And do you think Patricia de Lille has proven to be a good minister?
Well, there was the border fence.
Yeah, there was. There was the border fence.
Yeah, look.
Which Gayton has turned into his issue as well.
Uh-huh.
Right?
I think that she's been an outstanding minister. And I don't say that only because I'm in the same party as her. But I mean, by the president's own monitoring and evaluation of his ministers, he monitors all of them. She got 91% and a rating of exceptional, which means she delivered on most of her KPIs that she agreed to deliver on. She was sent to Public Works and Infrastructure to clean up was probably the most corrupt department in government. And she did a good job. She put in place, she gazetted rates so that South Africa's property, our rental of properties couldn't be overcharged. She gazetted rates for construction industry. She's really cleaned up and closed the loopholes for corrupt activities to take place. She brought the SIU in to find the crooked people within the department. This bait bridge thing is a half-baked story because actually as soon as she became aware that this fence was a problem, she again appointed the SIU. The officials who awarded the tender were suspended without pay, and the department went to court and got the profits that were made by the tenderer or the contractor repaid to the taxpayer. So those values and those things that South Africans saw in her, she took into government. And the same thing happened when she moved to tourism. Within 2 weeks, she cancelled that Tottenham Hotspurs deal. Mm. 1 billion rand she saved to the
Which
people
canceled,
of South Africa.
You thought might have been a good one. As I reckon. You didn't. Someone said to me that, I'm sure it was you.
I most certainly
Whenever did there's a controversial and wild opinion, I immediately attribute it to Camden. All right, but Brett, I mean, look, people are saying here, of course you're going to say that because she's your party leader. JP says, oh, sure, let's just trust Cyril's judgment. Do you think that you have the unfortunate problem that the DA has in that people have a higher standard in their minds for what you need to achieve, as opposed to like the ANC, where frankly, if they wake up in the morning, people are like, oh, well done, that's terrific. With the DA, with Good, perhaps with some of the other parties, they've kind of set themselves up as being better than, and therefore they're judged by a different set of standards.
That's a difficult question to answer. I think that we are, as opposition parties, expected to meet a different standard as opposed to the ANC. And there's often an expectation that we can actually do a lot, whereas in fact we have to fight a lot. And when the ANC's got an outright majority in parliament, they can still get away with shielding the speaker, shielding whoever. And so our voices need to be heard continuously, and people need to support those voices if they really want things to change. So we are held to a higher standard, and I think certainly, speaking for Good, I think we really strive to meet that standard. We take being elected as a privilege, and with that privilege comes huge responsibility. And that responsibility means honoring the commitments we made to voters when they voted for us.
Well, you know, you Antipat, essentially, has a history with the DA and in some ways coalitions. And everybody is talking about how this next election is going to really be made in the coalition space. So how are you, as Good, thinking about coalitions given your bad experience with the DA?
So our we were in coalition when we were the Independent Democrats, those of us who were in the Independent Democrats, with the DA in the city of Cape Town. That led to a merger of the two parties. Well, the ID joined the DA. So that wasn't really a coalition. maybe a sort of broad church coalition within one party. But we adopted at our conference in November a policy that will guide us on coalitions. So we're not talking about coalitions pre-elections. We'll talk about them afterwards, and we will consider whether we where we are needed to form a government, whether we should support or enter into a coalition. We're not opposed to it, but we at this point we are unaligned. We haven't said we won't work with this party and we won't work with that party. We will negotiate coalition agreements post the elections.
Is there someone you won't work with?
Won't work with. We haven't said that there's a party we won't work with. We have our policy that we adopted really says these are the four justices that we built our foundations and our policies on: spatial justice, social justice, economic justice, and environmental justice. That informs our manifesto and our policies, and where we can find agreement on the implementation on some of those things, because coalitions are compromise, then we will work with those parties.
So maybe let's talk a little bit about your policies and what your most important policies are going into 2024.
I think if you look at our manifesto and even going back about 18 months, you will see that we have focused extensively on the lived reality of the majority of South Africans and the fact that they are suffering living in poverty. 55% of South Africans live in poverty. Our most perhaps important, the most important aspects of our policies and our manifesto are to address the socioeconomic rights of South Africans. Mm. And that starts with saying we have high and entrenched poverty. We have high unemployment and we have low economic growth. And what we need to do is address the poverty straight away, immediately.
How do you do that?
With a basic income grant. From our bounty.
So where do you what do you cut back on in order to pay that basic income grant?
So this is not thumbsuck. We appointed economists to go and do the research for us. And in fact, we didn't need to do that because 20 years ago, the government commissioned their own investigation into a basic income grant, and it was found to be feasible.
We're looking at, 20-odd million? It keeps going up every week, people who are on social grants at the moment. And we know this is unsustainable. You want to add another layer of money to this and give a basic income grant to people as well. I think Canton's point is, where is this money going to come from? There's no economist who can manufacture magic.
So the starting point is not whether we should do it. It's what are the consequences of not doing it?
Okay, but where do we get it from?
Maybe if you allow me to speak.
I'm in agreement with what you are saying, but the question is, where does the money come from?
We need about 110 billion rand to pay the about 10 million people who will be unemployed, who are unemployed, and will be unemployed even if we achieve 3% economic growth over the next 15 years. We will remain at about 8 to 9 to 10 million people unemployed. They will not find work even if we triple our economic growth. We have a budget of 2.37 trillion and we're looking for 110 billion rand. If you start with allocative efficiencies, you look at what Tito Mboweni promised to do 3 years ago. Let's go zero-based budgeting and say the most important thing in order for South Africans or any human being to survive is water and food. We must provide at least the basics for people to meet that need. That goes in first in the budget. And then you build all around it. You can also say we've got a whole lot of the poverty alleviation programs running in the country. Let's test all of those for impact versus paying people 1,000 rand per month as a basic income grant. And you'll find that the cash transfer is probably more impactful than all of these poverty alleviation programs. So it starts with allocative efficiency. There's also obviously the clamping down on corruption and wastage.
That sounds like a lot of corporate speak that you're giving. My basic thing is we have a fixed pool of money in order for us to pay this grant. And I'm taking the view with you that, yes, you do need to make poverty alleviation something that's at the top of the food chain. Where do you take the money from? What do you cut back on? Because just simply saying that we allocate things more efficiently, that fundamentally means you cut back on something. What are the areas that we cut back on to get this 110 billion rand.
Well, we cut back on wastage. We cut back on programs that are duplicated amongst departments. We cut back on the amount of money being spent on provincial executives and provincial legislatures, which is in itself, the salaries just of MPLs is 4 billion rand a year. We cut back on the number of ministries and departments. So then we go into the budget and say, we've got this employment tax incentive. Is it really working? Is it creating is it creating employment for young people? It's giving companies a tax incentive, so reducing tax income, but not really producing results. We look at reforming tax deductions for wealthy South Africans. Very small percentage of South Africans can contribute 350,000 rand a year towards retirement annuities, but they get tax breaks if they can. And so you have to start cobbling this money together from really looking at the budget and at some tax reforms, and it can be achieved.
Well, I mean, optimistically, sure. You know, lots can be achieved. In
I'm just doing a quick calculation. So 110 billion rand spread among 55 million people works out to 2,000 rand a year.
So what are you trying to say? That's an extra 2,000 rand a year that...
No, what I'm saying is 2,000 rand a year divided by 12 months. So what sort of impact is that meant to be actually making?
Well, it's a very small impact.
Yeah, it's 186 rand a month.
And it's a very small impact. I mean, the thing is about the basic income grant is first finding the political will to do it. If you find the political will to do it, you can find the funding to do it. And the funding is in the budget. It's about cutting back on programs that are wasteful, that are not having impact.
But this is basically a road to disaster that's happened in so many places. No, everyone looks at Norway as an example, and they say Norway actually pays people who are not.
But that's because they've got
they've got a sovereign wealth fund. Exactly. Because they've actually grown the economy first. Now, you see, a lot of what I'm hearing you say, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, clearly. It's talking about stuff that's even more extractive than what we've got right now. Nothing is actually addressing how we grow the economy so that we have a bigger pool that we can then allocate resources more fairly. I mean, for example, what's your stance in terms of minimum wage, where we pricing the minimum wage at thousands of rands, so we're making it illegal for people to work for 1,000 rand a month, but we want to give them grants of 186 rand a month. To my mind, that's unconscionable. In fact, it's fundamentally immoral. So where's your stance on the minimum wage as an example? Our labor laws have been consistently targeted by many people around the world as an obstacle to economic growth. What about broad-based black economic empowerment? Again, it's another thing that holds us back. So,
well, let him answer it.
I think you're making some generalizations. I don't know. 186 rand per month is, I don't know where that comes from. That's how you
well,
work.
Well, it's 110 billion rand divided by 55 million people, which gives you 2,000 rand a year divided by 12.
You're talking about universal basic income.
they will decide. The good party will decide who deserves that money.
The policy we're presenting is for the 10 million or the 8 or 9, 10 million.
They'll take your
unemployed
money, but they won't.
No, we definitely will take it we'll redistribute it. But, you've asked me like three or four questions at once.
Yeah, give him a chance to answer.
I mean, I was addressing the poverty part, but sure. It did indicate we have a low economic growth crisis. So we have to address the low economic growth crisis. We cannot accept that it's normal, acceptable for the Minister of Finance to stand up and say we're going to have a 1% economic growth over the medium term and not present a coherent plan to actually change that to at least 5% economic growth, which will meaningfully create employment and then reduce the number of people in poverty and reduce the number of people who would qualify for the basic income grant. Because we're ring-fencing the basic income grant for unemployed adults between the ages of 18 and 60 who don't qualify for any other social support, of which there are about 8 or 9 million of them currently. The generalization that black economic empowerment or triple B double E has held us back. There's no evidence that it's held us back.
Oh,
there's definitely no
really?
Evidence. No,
wait.
There's no evidence for it at all.
Give him a chance.
And we also have to redress our economy. We can't not as a state be active in encouraging the economic transformation in our country. And the tool to do that currently is BBBEE. It's not a perfect tool. It's definitely not a perfect tool. But nobody has come up with a better tool. So how do we redistribute or encourage companies to ensure that those who were excluded previously are included in this economy? And the BBBEE basically says, if you want to do government with the state, a business with the state, you need to have a certain level of BBBEE status. Right, so and you can achieve it in various ways.
You're pro that. Let's leave that alone. So you're not going to change the minimum wage. You're not going to change this. And you want to extract more money from taxpayers to give to people who are not taxpayers. I'm just putting it all in like black and white.
Put bluntly, yes, we want the fiscus to fund the ability for
not
people
the fiscus,
to live.
People who
pay tax. Okay, right. The people who pay tax create the fiscus. And the fiscus belongs to all of us. And we don't want 9 million people to starve to death.
And it's incumbent on everyone else. Because Patrick V. Riss is here in the comments. Do you have any benefits planned for all these people who you're going to be charging more tax money?
Benefits.
Benefits for them, yeah. Are there any reasons for them to keep paying their tax and being a good taxpayer? Like, or should they start thinking about moving their money away?
Yeah, look,
dishonest.
I guess we're appealing to a higher order of consciousness about we're all in this together.
But you don't ask for that higher order of consciousness from people who are going to get this basic income grant. They must just carry on taking from the state.
But are you assuming that the fact that they're unemployed is their fault?
No, but perhaps this will encourage more people to be unemployed.
No, I don't. I mean, 1,000 rand a month can't possibly encourage more people to stay out of work when the minimum wage is what, 3,500 rand per month. So, I mean, you would be talking about people who are lunatics, really, to say, I'm going to sit at home for 1,000 rand a month when I've been offered this job. It doesn't make sense. And in fact, actually, pilot projects have shown that paying cash transfers as a basic income grant fundamentally changes the employment status of those recipients. The pilot projects have been done in Namibia and Kenya, close to home. We don't have to use Norway as an example. And the economy in those communities where a basic income grant has been paid to those recipients, people have found employment or created their own employment. And entrepreneurship is a huge problem in South Africa. We have low entrepreneurship. We need to be encouraging more. In fact, the Good Party, we're testing doing our own pilot project. We've taken 1,000 rand, which is more or less what we're saying people should receive. Mm-hmm. We've given it to unemployed people and said, how would you start a micro enterprise? And people are doing that. We've got about 50 or 60 people in three provinces currently who were seed funded by the Good Party with 1,000 rand who are now micro traders, making a living for their family. So I don't think we should be saying, what is the benefit for us? The benefit for all of us, those of us who have means, is that we have a socially sustainable country where people are not starving.
So you just have
to. We're currently having a conversation that is pretty intellectual about many parts of what's going wrong and could get better in our country. But we're also, when you're talking to voters, you're also talking on average to somebody that is 26, 27 years old, with a very low level of education, because when we look at what it looks like, our matric pass rates and people who finish school. So how do you think, as good, you are translating all of this so that it appeals to what we know is the most important part of the electorate currently?
Well, if the most important part of the electorate is young people who are disillusioned because they're unemployed, because they have low or inadequate education, and also because we have an economy that's not creating jobs, that's the reality.
Whose fault is that, by the way, your opinion?
Let him answer that question
first. I want to know about like where this bad economy comes from, because we have to ascribe this to somebody.
Well, I don't. I mean, as I said in Parliament, our government, the ANC government, would like to blame the 2008 financial crisis. But 2008 is 16 years ago. And Most countries have recovered. And in
Zimbabwe
Africa,
Zimbabwe has had better economic growth over that period.
So I'm making the same point that in Africa, the average economic growth is currently 5 to 6%. 22 countries in this financial year will achieve 5 to 6% economic growth in Africa. And South Africa is reducing the average in Southern Africa.
So how come?
Because
we have broad-based economic empowerment.
No, because we don't have the basics for growth in place. We don't have we have an unstable electricity supply. We don't have logistics, transport.
Whose fault is all of that?
It is the failure of the state.
Right. And you want to give the state more control, more power.
In what way?
Well, I mean, in terms of, for example, basic income grants and growth of the economy.
I want to give the state the duty that they already have in terms of the Constitution to make sure that nobody lives and or wakes up every single day with zero income, expected to live in a country where you need money to buy things. Do you need money to buy food, basic food? The basic the food poverty line is 760 rand per month. That's what an adult needs to meet their basic food requirements. And we have 8 or 9 million people who are currently waking up to 350 rand per month, which, yay for them, it goes up to 370 rand per month on the 1st of April. Yeah. But I want to live in a country where those 9 million people are not starving. You know, in Inyanga, in Cape Town, I met a young man, 27 years old, unemployed, never had a job. And when I asked him how he was surviving, he very shyly or embarrassingly said he slaughters cats. He finds a cat that's wandering by. He slaughters it and boils it in this Rick coffee can to eat. We know that there was a woman in Eastern Cape just a few months ago who killed herself, her three children, and then herself because she was unable to feed them. And the irony is that it was the debt collector who found her family all dead. We know that in KwaZulu-Natal, children are eating sand in order to fill their stomachs. That's not the country that I would like to live in. And we can find the resources to make sure that those people can at least feed themselves.
Okay.
So I'm going to remind you of my question,
yes,
because I never did get an answer to my question. No,
at least you answered the question about food, which Julius couldn't, about loaf bread, right? So well done on that front.
So how do you make your message appealing to young people?
The message, if young people, I mean, look, we have to reach young people, and young people are disillusioned, and rightfully so. But our message is directed at them. They are the ones who make up the bulk of unemployed people in South Africa. They're the ones who have been let down by the education system, which doesn't prepare them for work. And, of course, they're the ones that are living in a country where the economy is not generating jobs, while many of us already have entrenched jobs. And we're not saying, like Herman Mashaba, that you must stay at work until you die. But the point is they wake up to this reality that we are trying to address, which is that they wake up with no income. They don't qualify for a grant or social service, social security, because they're 26 years old, so they're outside of the category. And so we're saying to them, we will help you. You will be provided with the minimum requirements that you need in order to survive. At 1,000 rand per month, you can meet your food requirement. You can buy some data for your phone, so you can make applications for jobs, and you can occasionally buy a bus or train ticket to go and look for work or go for an interview. So providing that income is an opportunity for them to find some mobility in this economy, or to find, if they're entrepreneurial, to start some micro trading enterprise. And so I think our message is appealing to young people because it addresses directly their everyday reality.
We spoke earlier about seeing your posters in the Western Cape, in Cape Town specifically. And I think you've got two seats in Parliament.
Yes.
You've got two seats in Parliament. So you're largely a regional party. You know, you're in the Western Cape. You're very strong there. That's also where your voter base has been. Do you think that your message can carry into the rest of the country, or should you be concentrating your efforts in the region?
So most of our votes in the last two elections did come from the Western Cape, but we managed in the last election to get two council seats in the Northern Cape, two in Gauteng, and two in the Eastern Cape. So there is some growth in other provinces, and we are hoping to get seats in those other provinces. The message that we are sharing with South Africans is universal to South Africa. It's not confined to the Western Cape. The reason you saw our posters up in the Western Cape, but you haven't yet seen them up in Gauteng or anywhere else, is because in the Western Cape we already had the backing boards, the hard boards, and
that's expensive,
and it's very expensive. Yeah. And so for the rest of the country, we're printing Corex.
And you know, reasonably, you can't be everywhere. You can't campaign everywhere. There are some parties that just cannot do that. Mm. There are even large parties that have decided to forego campaigning in certain areas. You know, I do want to move away from the economic stuff, but I do notice you said the four justices, social justice, economic justice, spatial justice, we have to still talk about, and environmental justice. But this is the kind of language that is like 10 years old already in America and has not delivered the voters that it was intended to. A lot of this stuff, social justice in particular, if it's justice, it doesn't need the social in front of it. What does that mean to you? And is this just like the leftist stuff we've seen in America that's failed so dismally, or is it different?
Well, it's not language for the sake of language. It helps us to position ourselves and to develop policies. So we test our policies against these justices. But really, they are all interrelated. I mean, I think you're correct. They're all about creating a just society. And in that just society, you have to address challenges that are like economic exclusion. So in the economic justice space, we'll address economic exclusion. So it helps us translate a just society.
So you're not using it as a prefix to justice to give it a different meaning. You're just saying these are the categories in which we'd like to see more of that.
And it guides how we develop policy.
Because social justice has come to mean very, very different things to justice in a society.
Yeah, social justice in the South African society is about redressing and addressing our historic legacy, largely.
So then it is the same as social justice in America?
It's, to some extent, there are similarities. I mean, so the United States has similar discriminatory history. But social justice in South Africa is more because it includes addressing poverty at a scale that no other country in the world almost has to address. So poverty is both an economic justice issue, but also a social justice issue.
Yeah, I think what, that these
how
these
much of a cut
matter,
in salaries yeah. do you think MPs should take?
Cut in salaries?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they currently earn. What is it? What's the basic salary that you guys earn in Parliament?
Well, the total cost of employment is about 1.2 million.
Right.
But so the salary part is about 600,000 or 700,000.
So how much of a cut should parliamentarians take? Because, you know, it's very clear that, you know, someone is, you know, it's leading by example, surely. You know, I'm of the view, for example, that a 35% cut is actually good for all politicians because, you know, that's pretty much the percentage of the budget that goes to pay for public service.
So 35% cut would then eliminate public service?
No, I think that it would substantially reduce the burden, which could then go towards social grants, don't you think?
Yeah, look, I don't have an issue debating a cut in salaries to Parliament. I'm not... I mean, I personally don't do this for a salary. I do it because
to my point.
I haven't put a figure on what parliamentarians should earn and whether their salary should be cut. My concern around cutting salaries is you're going to reduce the quality of parliamentarians. I think without disparaging anybody, there's a relatively low level of quality in Parliament already. I think the quality could be much better, and maybe we'd have better outcomes. So, if you want to attract people who are patriotic and want South Africa to succeed, but who are also educated, qualified, or experienced, and education doesn't have to be formal education. Any experience, work experience, is valuable. I think you have to pay them appropriately.
Are you guys, to Pumi's earlier question, are you part of this multi-party charter? Do you not want to be a part of that? What do you think of the rest of the opposition? I mean, you did say that you're open to coalitions with anybody. But what do you think of all of them? I mean, they're all talking big games and talking about big numbers. And we've had them in here professing that they're all going to sing kumbaya after the election and then just decide which cabinet positions they want to apportion to who. You don't want to be a part of that conversation.
No, we don't want to be part of it. I mean, it's obviously their right to announce prior to an election that these parties will work together to form a government if they could reach 50% plus one. You know, I mean, our approach to coalitions, as I said earlier, is to say this is what we've gone to voters and asked them to support. After the election, we would have had hopefully a few hundred thousand voters who supported us. And we would have to honor that vote. We can't honor it by before the election saying we're going to partner with parties that don't share our values, don't share our policies, but we're just doing it because we want to be anti-ANC or get the ANC out. Because that's not going to be a sustainable coalition government afterwards.
Speaking of sustainability, I've asked this question of other politicians who've sat here in the same place as you. So Patricia de Lille has been part of our government from the jump, and she is still the leader of your party. What's your succession plan?
Our constitution says that our leader has to develop a succession plan. She's obviously standing for re-election in this election. She was re-elected as our leader unopposed in November 2023. And so over the next 5 years, I would say it is her duty to work on a succession plan.
You are the only other person, aside from Peter de Villiers, who I know in the Good Party. I mean, I'm sure there are lots of other people who are noteworthy, but they haven't really made any noise publicly, and maybe that's a good thing. Peter de Villiers, you guys have just you've terminated his membership, right? Because you got a bit handsy. Is that what happened?
Handsy? Is that the word we're using? Is that the euphemism these days?
He got a bit handsy.
Is that the euphemism these days?
There are accusations of
impropriety,
sexual harassment, and so on. It's a serious thing. But you terminated his membership. Is it easy to fill those spaces once you get rid of someone? And was he? Did he kick and scream a lot when you said to him, "Hey, by the way, you're out"?
Look, I mean, it's not easy to terminate anyone's membership, and we, a party that follows due process, so sometimes these processes take a frustratingly long time. But we, when we got the complaint on the 31st of January, we suspended him within hours.
No, it was quick. And give yourselves credit on that front.
We, I mean, we walk the talk. We can't just talk about gender-based violence and not deliver on it.
We've got a speaker in the ruling party at the moment who has got serious criminal allegations. Yeah. Brought against her, and she's still sitting around on paid leave.
Yeah, and that's the point I've been making around the speakers, that the ANC has a duty really to resolve this. I mean, they have a constitution and rules, and they must resolve it. But yes, we do have a lot of talent in the party, and we Peter was his membership was terminated on Sunday, and on Monday we had a new member of the provincial parliament sworn in. Her name is Suzette Little, and she has a lot of experience. She was a mayoral committee member in the city of Cape Town, and she was a councillor, and she's someone whose voice I think you'll hear.
Little for good. Instead of good for little, which is much worse. Canton, you've been sitting there quietly, which people are not used to.
You know, it's kind of like we're talking at entirely different levels.
Go back to your level. It's fine. You're saying Pumi and I ask stupid questions. Go on.
Let's take your four justice pillars that we were talking about. But, you know, fundamentally, if you're going to take a look in terms of where jobs are going to come from. So let's say that we've managed to put aside the question of the basic income grant and it's in place. How do we grow the economy? Where are the areas that you can see South Africa being a world leader, given all of the challenges that you've spoken about, given all of the disillusionment? How do we actually grow this economy? What are the specific areas that we can take a look at? Is it finance? Is it technology? Is it tourism? Is it paying women to be surrogate mothers? What's the solution?
You ask your questions a very interesting way because you almost answer, then start answering them before I get a chance to answer.
Well, you go ahead. But co-opt what he said and add some.
Yeah, I'll cooperate and co-opt. As I said earlier, we have to get the basics for growth in place. So that is addressing all the challenges around electricity, logistics, the digital space, releasing spectrum, and addressing water shortages. So we have an infrastructure problem in South Africa. So it starts with addressing our infrastructure problem. We have, for two reasons. First of all, there's a huge disparity in infrastructure across the country between communities. So there's a need to invest in infrastructure.
Let's say we've done that.
And let me just make the point. The point is it's been done before, investing in infrastructure to take a country out of depression into success.
Give us specific examples of infrastructure.
So we must invest heavily in infrastructure.
What type?
We must transportation infrastructure, so roads and rail, road and rail infrastructure must be. We must invest in that. We must invest in water infrastructure, the reticulation of water. We have to fix our electricity supply. Mm-hmm. We have to invest in ICT infrastructure, so the digital infrastructure. Those are the basics for growth.
Let me interrupt for a second because, once again, what we are talking about is all of the extractive stuff. What I want to know is, how do we make the cake bigger? Where does the economic growth
go? Well, we're not going to make the cake bigger for as long as we don't have the infrastructure in place that will attract and allow businesses.
Once we have
that in place, then we have the green economy that we need to. We've been talking about the green economy since 2010, when President Zuma presented one of the many economic growth plans. In 2010, the green economy was in this economic framework.
Tell us what the green economy means. The green economy is transitioning
from obviously fossil fuel to renewable sources of energy and producing the components in South Africa for the green economy. So we've already we're importing solar panels, billions of rands worth of solar panels from China.
We can make them. Components that go into a solar panel, and do we have them available here?
I don't know what the components are that go into a solar panel, but I know that we're importing them. Why are you asking that? I'm asking
because this idea that we can manufacture the solar panels here is pie in the sky, because we need rare earth elements that China has an abundance of and we don't have them.
But we can assemble. We can import the parts that we need. We can assemble. We've already done this in Atlantis in Cape Town when we were in the city of Cape Town. When we were part of government in the city of Cape Town, we provided special rates in an impoverished environment in Atlantis in Cape Town, and encouraged the green economy industry to go there. So we've got components.
So it's a subsidy.
It was a rates-based subsidy, yes.
And once again, it's extractive. It's not growing the economy.
And even really, with fairness, Brett, even the green economy, right, is essentially doing something we don't need in order to create jobs that we also don't need. If we had already solved the energy problem with Eskom, and let's say because we have cheap coal and we can burn that and create the energy that we need, energy does feed the economy. Once that's going, why would we want to supplement something that's already working with something that we're not sure will work, because it could be hugely expensive and it might not be as generative of the power that we require?
But we don't have enough generative power capacity. But remember, so we do need to supplement the generation capacity. And the quickest and cheapest way of doing that is probably to add renewables.
And you're not wrong. Most people who can afford that have already done it, and most businesses have already done so. That's why you see solar panels up everywhere, and it's a huge, growing, booming part of the economy. But the reality is that alone is not going to bring the jobs about that will alleviate this problem that we have the basic income growth. It's one component,
the question was, what are the industries that we need to support in order to grow the economy? So green economy is one of them. Tourism is obviously the other. The investment in infrastructure is an investment in the construction sector. Investment in I've lost my train of thought.
That's okay. It's a lot of people coming from every direction.
But I did want to make the point
that part of growing the economy is investing in entrepreneurship. And the barrier to growing our entrepreneurship is access to finance.
But the barrier is also the government.
The government, yes. Listen, I started a business 20 years ago. I can assure you, if you've got an entrepreneurial spirit, no red tape is going to stop you from starting a business. What stops you from starting a business is access to finance. I got access to finance because I'm a graduate. And when I went to Business Partners, which was the old Small Business Development Corporation, they said to me, we'll give you this loan. I had no collateral because we know that you're a qualified lawyer. And if you can't pay the loan back, you'll go back and practice law and you'll pay it back. So access to finance is the great barrier to entrepreneurship.
What was your business, by the way?
My business is legal skills training.
Yeah, look, I think that's there are many other reasons why that access to finance was easily available to you.
Course.
But I don't want us to talk about
that. I'm aware of that.
I really would like you to forecast for us a little bit, based on all of your polling and your intel within your party, what this election is going to look like and what you're going to look like on the other side of it.
We started the conversation with Gareth. Saying, accusing, and being disparaging about parties who come in here who give percentages.
Not even me. No, it's like the audience are like, wow, 10%. That's a little bit grand.
No, really, because I'll tell you why. I really would like to hear, because we are going to have this exercise post the election and see where the chips have fallen. But it's important to understand. I would like to understand where the mind of your party is at going into this election and what you think you're going to do after that.
So we would like, as I said, we're on a trajectory of growth and we would like to continue that growth. And we don't mind being a small party that is growing, a small party that is true to its values and true to its policies and knows who it is and growing. So we currently, and we started 3 months before the 2019 elections and we managed to get 2 seats. We were one of only 2 new parties that got seats in the National Assembly when there were about 14 or 15 on the ballot paper. So we would like to grow. If we can grow and get 10 members of parliament, we would be ecstatic. So if we can go from 2 to 4 to 6, that would show growth. Mm-hmm. We would like to increase the number of seats in the Western Cape Provincial Parliament. We got one. We got one with about 60,000 votes. Al Jamar got one with 17,000 votes. There's something seriously wrong with that formula.
Yeah.
But in any event, we would like to grow to 2 or 3 or 4 members in the provincial parliament. We would like a seat in the Northern Cape, in Gauteng, and the Eastern Cape.
Okay, that's interesting to know. What about Cape Exit? You know, there's still people who think this is a thing. So,
I don't think it's a thing. And I mean, it's rooted in all kinds of ideology that I find repulsive. It's also interesting to engage with people around Cape Exit.
Why do you find it repulsive, by the way?
Because
that's quite a word to use in politics. Everybody tries to dumb things down, but that's quite a...
Because it seems to be based, or it's based on this idea that, first of all, the Western Cape is this utopia, and it's not for many people who live in the Western Cape, and that we have to keep the ANC out. And right now, the Western Cape is governed by the DA, so let's be a different country.
But the DA is not calling for Cape Exit.
They flirt. You see the thing about the DA. You must watch.
Be fair,
they flirt. This Western Cape Powers Bill is an attempt to kind of appease some of them. They allow some of their members to flirt with really strange things.
That's fair, but then,
in social media space, because they create confusion that they are maybe inclined to be Cape Exit,
but not really.
Let's not go there.
Why is it repulsive?
So I've told you why I think it's repulsive. But the thing about state independence universally across the world is that there has to be a historic reason for it. There has to be
conquest?
No, I mean there has to have been the way I understand the world recognizes statehood and or the right to independence is got a historical context, and our Western Cape our history is really an arbitrary line that was drawn in the sand in 1994. Because before 1994, the Cape was actually the Northern Cape, the Eastern Cape, and Western Cape. But this Cape Exodus is not talking about those capes, which maybe historically you could argue was a country on its own prior to unification in South Africa.
It was.
But now the Western Cape is not. The Western Cape was a compromise in 1994 to create nine provinces. This group that is talking about the Western Cape definitely doesn't want the Eastern Cape included.
No.
Because those people are the wrong color and vote for the wrong party. So I think it's going nowhere, and I think it's repulsive for many reasons, including that it has no historical basis.
Okay, but it's repulsive is a very strong word.
It is repulsive.
Are there other parties that you're paying special attention to, like MK? What do you think their role is going to be? Because I always like to hear from the leaders of parties and from the people in prominent positions, like you're the Secretary General for Good, what you think of all these people. Because we've got
the competition.
Jacob Zuma coming in. It's easy for you guys to talk about your own party, but you sometimes get very honest answers from people in your position about the other guys. So what do you think of MK making a lot of noise?
Well, I mean, I've been wildly impressed that they managed to get where they got to so quickly and so quietly. Suddenly they popped up and they have a full list on the national list. You know, they've obviously been preparing for a long time, and I think it's impressive. I think they probably will do well in KwaZulu-Natal. I see no sign of them really in the Western Cape. So I think they're an interesting mix in the competition of new parties who are wanting to enter parliament and enter the provincial legislatures. But I don't see much of them outside of KwaZulu-Natal, but I must say it's impressive what they've managed to achieve in a short space of time.
All right, anything else, Canton?
There was a question that came up in the comments, Gareth, which was, you know, would you support conscription and then free university for those who go through the process?
So in other words,
you become conscripted, and then once you've served, you get free university.
Well, like the taxpayer has to pay to make a better society, then how about we put those people who are getting that payment into, you know, conscription, working in the military, getting some skills training at the same time, and then
it's not a bad idea. I haven't thought of it. It's not a policy of the party, but our policy is to support free education. But it's not a bad idea.
By the way, what do you think of the closure of Damlin and all these other institutions by Bladen Zimande?
Well, I think it's good, and especially for those of us who have a small business in skills training, that dodgy colleges are closed down.
Because you think they're dodgy? They're all dodgy.
Well, I don't think they're all dodgy. I don't think they're all dodgy. I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Pumi's pulling faces.
Grace, I'm going to let you continue with your train of thought, and I hope you don't forget it. I think, though, that there is something very dodgy in what we've seen happen over the past couple of years. This government is very good at breaking things and shutting things down, and not so good at starting other things. I mean, I think when I think about Damlin, which has been around for a very, very, very long time. Yeah. And we know people who have been through that system. I think that there are lots of ways of fixing where there is a problem. And I don't know how much of that engagement has been done with some of these organizations. I mean, even City Varsity, which is a fairly new college, and working in the creative industry, we have seen many young people come through that system and get into and be very viable individuals within the, you know, within the business.
They had real skills for me.
And I think that if you scratch past the surface, like with one other minister that for many years everybody has thought he's the good guy, I think if you scratch past the surface, you're going to find a very dodgy experience with this particular minister and these organizations.
Are we talking about Praveen?
Maybe. Yeah, that Praveen.
We don't mince our words on this show.
I think with Blade and with these particular colleges and with what has happened, I think if you scratch past the surface, you're going to find a dodgy deal there.
I think that
more than you're going to find dodgy institutions.
I really like the comment you make, but I mean, first of all, I say dodgy with, I mean, dodgy because according to the minister, they inflated their numbers. But there is a, you're correct. Like that he has a system that is broken by the state, because I actually just asked a question recently to the Minister of Higher Education around how much money is being collected from the skills levy. And the skills levy is supposed to fund the CETAs, which is supposed to fund people who are studying vocational training.
How much money has been disbursed?
Well, and that's the problem. They're sitting on 14 billion rand in the skills fund right now, while you have millions of young people unemployed who should be getting learnerships at colleges that are accredited and properly run and funded through the skills levy that employers are paying. So yes, you're right. This is something that has been broken by the state, who've collected the money from employers. 14 billion rand is currently sitting in the bank, while you have people who could actually be sent to accredited institutions and get qualifications using that money.
And there are many administrators in that system who are getting paid a salary every month, while those young people don't get the
leaderships. Give you an example from my own business. As I said, it's a legal skills training business. A law firm wanted to send 20 or 10 of their employees through our program, which is a paralegal skills training program, a qualification. They applied for the learnership in February 2023. Now they've been paying levies. It was approved only in March 2024, with still no sign of when we can start training these people. A whole year that this law firm has waited to get their own money back that they paid in skills levies to train their staff.
And in exactly the example that you give, which you have personal experience of, lived experience, people would say, the government is the bad guy. Because here is a law firm trying to do business. They're trying to do business with you, get qualified people who they want to be upskilled to work with them. And it can't be done because of government.
Yeah, I agree. It's a failure of that system, failure of government.
Brett, one final question from my side. Would you agree that you're a socialist?
I've been called worse, but yes, I think I'm a democratic socialist. But right. Our party is a social democratic party.
So give me an example of a place that you would use as a prototype, a role model for the type of society we should grow in South Africa.
No, I think
looking around the world, what country would you say you are using as a model?
And even in history.
Emulate?
No, I don't think I can do that, because I think we must stop trying to emulate what other countries in the Northern Hemisphere have done. South Africa
says the Northern Hemisphere, anywhere in the world.
I mean, South Africa has a unique history, and we must find solve the legacy of that history in our own unique way. And to some extent, part of that involves some social interventions, which may make me a socialist. But I'm not going to say, well, Norway is this utopia, because it's not. I don't know of a country that has gone through what South Africa's gone through that needs to address the kind of challenges and legacies that we have. And I would like us to create our own unique response to those challenges.
So 30 seconds to convince our listeners why they should vote for anti-PAT and good.
Because South Africans are suffering, and we all have a responsibility, whether we have means or not, to ensure that those who are suffering receive some support from the state. And in order to achieve that, we need to grow our economy, grow our employment. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for that economy to grow and for jobs to be created, we need to take care of those who are excluded and left behind.
Very interesting stuff. We can't accuse you of not answering things. Some of your answers might not be to everyone's satisfaction. I think we've gone pretty much all the way we can. And I wish you luck for the election, as
Thank
I have
you.
Everybody.
Thanks very much.
It's going to be a hell of an election. I think everybody's of the opinion that this is the most important one in a while. Let's see what happens.
You know, what one thing we did not speak about today, which I did want to talk about, is the 42 people who are appearing on multiple party lists. But that is the story for next week.
Well,
come back next week. We'll talk about that.
We'll have more for that. All right. Thank you, everybody. We will see you next Thursday. And also, good luck for the long weekend. Tomorrow's Easter for those celebrating that. For those people who are just looking for a nice weekend off, whatever your reason.
You got that too.
Yeah, we don't judge. Cheers. We'll see you on Monday. No, Tuesday.